The Select Committee to Investigate the January 6th Attack on the United States Capitol will be in order. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare the committee in recess at any point. Pursuant to House Deposition Authority Regulation 10, the chair announces the committee's approval to release the deposition material presented during today's hearing. Good afternoon. In our previous hearings, the Select Committee showed that then President Trump applied pressure at every level of government, from local election workers up to his own vice president, hoping public servants would give in to that pressure and help him steal an election he actually lost. Today, we'll tell the story of how the pressure campaign also targeted the federal agency charged with enforcement of our laws, the Department of Justice. We already covered part of Mr. Trump's effort. We heard from Attorney General Bill Barr tell the story and the committee about the baseless claims Mr. Trump wanted the Justice Department to investigate, and that Mr. Barr viewed those claims as nonsense. Today, we'll hear from Jeffrey Rosen, the person Mr. Trump appointed to run the Justice Department after Attorney General Barr resigned. We'll hear from other senior Justice Department officials also. Together, these public servants resisted Mr. Trump's effort to misuse the Justice Department as part of his plan to hold on to power. And we will show that Trump's demands that the department investigate baseless claims of election fraud continued into January 2021. But Donald Trump didn't just want the Justice Department to investigate. He wanted the Justice Department to help legitimize his lies, to basically call the election corrupt, to appoint a special counsel to investigate alleged election fraud, to send a letter to six state legislatures urging them to consider altering the election results. And when these and other efforts fail, Donald Trump sought to replace Mr. Rosen, the acting attorney general, with a lawyer who he believed would inappropriately put the full weight of the Justice Department behind the effort to overturn the election. Let's think about what that means. Wherever you live in the United States, there's probably a local government executive, a mayor, or a county commissioner. There's also an official responsible for enforcing the laws, a district attorney or a local prosecutor. Imagine if your mayor lost a re-election bid, but instead of conceding the race, they picked up the phone, called the district attorney, and said, "I want you to say this election was stolen. I want you to tell the Board of Elections not to certify the results." That's essentially what Donald Trump was trying to do with the election for President of the United States. It was a brazen attempt to use the Justice Department to advance the president's personal political agenda. Today, my colleague from Illinois, Mr. Kinzinger, and other witnesses will walk through the Select Committee's findings on these matters. But first, I recognize our distinguished Vice Chair, Ms. Cheney of Wyoming, for any opening statement she's cared to offer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. At this point, our committee has just begun to show America the evidence that we have gathered. There is much more to come, both in our hearings and in our report. But I'd like to take just a moment to put everything we've seen in context. We have already seen how President Trump falsely declared victory on November 3rd, 2020, how he and his team launched a fraudulent media campaign that persuaded tens of millions of Americans that the election was stolen from him. Donald Trump intentionally ran false ads on television and social media, featuring allegations that his advisors and his Justice Department repeatedly told him were untrue. We have also seen how Donald Trump launched a fraudulent fundraising campaign that raised hundreds of millions of dollars again, based on those same false election fraud allegations. We have seen how President Trump and his allies corruptly attempted to pressure Vice President Pence to refuse to count lawful electoral votes and obstruct Congress's proceedings on January 6th, and how he provoked a violent mob to pursue the Vice President and others in our Capitol. We have seen how the President oversaw and personally participated in an effort in multiple states to vilify, threaten, and pressure election officials, and to use false allegations to pressure state legislators to change the outcome of the election. We have seen how President Trump worked with and directed the Republican National Committee and others to organize an effort to create fake electoral slates, and later to transmit those materially false documents to federal officials, again as part of his planning for January 6th. We have seen how President Trump persuaded tens of thousands of his supporters to travel to Washington, D.C. for January 6th. And we will see in far more detail how the President's rally and march to the Capitol were organized and choreographed. As you can tell, these efforts were not some minor or ad hoc enterprise concocted overnight. Each required planning and coordination. Some required significant funding. All of them were overseen by President Trump. And much more information will be presented soon regarding the President's statements and actions on January 6th. Today, as Chairman Thompson indicated, we turn to yet another element of the President's effort to overturn the 2020 election, this one involving the Department of Justice. A key focus of our hearing today will be a draft letter that our witnesses here today refused to sign. This letter was written by Mr. Jeff Clark with another Department of Justice lawyer, Ken Klukowski, and the letter was to be sent to the leadership of the Georgia State Legislature. Other versions of the letter were intended for other states. Neither Mr. Clark nor Mr. Klukowski had any evidence of widespread election fraud, but they were quite aware of what Mr. Trump wanted the department to do. Jeff Clark met privately with President Trump and others in the White House and agreed to assist the president without telling the senior leadership of the department who oversaw him. As you will see, this letter claims that the U.S. Department of Justice's investigations have, quote, identified significant concerns that may have impacted the outcome of the election in multiple states, including the state of Georgia. In fact, Donald Trump knew this was a lie. The Department of Justice had already informed the President of the United States repeatedly that its investigations had found no fraud sufficient to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The letter also said this, quote, in light of these developments, the department recommends that the Georgia General Assembly should convene in special session, end quote, and consider approving a new slate of electors. And it indicates that a separate, quote, fake slate of electors supporting Donald Trump has already been transmitted to Washington, D.C. For those of you who have been watching these hearings, the language of this draft Justice Department letter will sound very familiar. The text is similar to what we have seen from John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, both of whom were coordinating with President Trump to overturn the 2020 election. When one of our witnesses today, Mr. Donahue, first saw this draft letter, he wrote this, quote, this would be a grave step for the department to take, and it could have tremendous constitutional, political, and social ramifications for the country, end quote. This committee agrees. Had this letter been released on official Department of Justice letterhead, it would have falsely informed all Americans, including those who might be inclined to come to Washington on January 6th, that President Trump's election fraud allegations were likely very real. Here is another observation about this letter. Look at the signature line. It was written by Jeff Clark and Mr. Klukowski, not just for Clark's signature, but also for our witnesses today, Jeff Rosen and Richard Donahue. When it became clear that neither Mr. Rosen nor Mr. Donohue would sign this letter, President Trump's plan necessarily changed. As you will hear today, Donald Trump offered Mr. Clark the job of acting Attorney General, replacing Mr. Rosen, with the understanding that Clark would send this letter to Georgia and other states and take other actions the President requested. One other point. Millions of Americans have seen the testimony of Attorney General Barr before this committee. At one point in his deposition, the former Attorney General was asked why he authorized the Department of Justice to investigate fraud in the 2020 election at all. Why not just follow the regular course of action and let the investigations occur much later in time, after January 6th? Here's what he said.
Felt the responsible thing to do was to be in a position to have a view as to whether or not there was fraud. And frankly, I think the fact that I put myself in the position that I could say that we had looked at this and didn't think there was fraud was really important to moving things forward. And I sort of shudder to think what the situation would have been if the position of the department was, we're not even looking at this until after Biden's in office. I'm not sure we would have had a transition at all.
I want to thank each of our witnesses before us today for your role in addressing and rebutting the false allegations of fraud at the root of January 6th. And thank you for standing up for the Constitution and for the rule of law. Of course, not all public officials behaved in the honorable way our witnesses did. At the close of today's hearing, we will see video testimony by three members of Donald Trump's White House staff. They will identify certain of the members of Congress who contacted the White House after January 6th to seek presidential pardons for their conduct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Kinzinger, for an opening statement.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our witnesses for being here. I'd like to start with a personal story. So in May of 2009, I returned from service in Iraq, and I announced my intention to run for Congress. A big reason I decided to run for Congress was my motivation to ensure freedom and democracy were defended overseas. I remember making a commitment out loud a few times and in my heart repeatedly, even to today, that if we are going to ask Americans to be willing to die in service to our country, we as leaders must at least be willing to sacrifice our political careers when integrity and our oath requires it. After all, losing a job is nothing compared to losing your life. Within the halls of power, in the face of a president, that commitment can easily be forgotten. Presidential pressure can be really hard to resist. Today, we'll focus on a few officials who stood firm against President Trump's political pressure campaign. When the president tried to misuse the department and install a loyalist at its helm, these brave officials refused and threatened to resign. They were willing to sacrifice their careers for the good of our country. The Department of Justice is unique in the executive branch. The president oversees the Department of Justice, yet the president's personal or partisan interests must not shape or dictate the department's actions. The president cannot and must not use the department to serve his own personal interest, and he must not use its people to do his political bidding, especially when what he wants them to do is to subvert democracy. The president cannot pervert justice nor the law to maintain his power. Justice must, both in fact and law, be blind. That is critical to our whole system of self-governance. During this hearing, you'll hear time and time again about the president's request to investigate claims of widespread fraud. Our witnesses, Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donohue, and Mr. Engel, stood firm in the face of overbearing political pressure because they understood that their oath was to the Constitution and not to the personal or political interests of the president. The president and his allies became keenly aware that with legal challenges exhausted and electoral votes certified, their only hope would be a last-ditch scheme to prevent Congress from certifying the win, thus throwing the entire system into constitutional chaos. The president wanted the department to sow doubt in the legitimacy of the election, to empower his followers and members of Congress to take action. If the department could just lend its credibility to the conspiracies, people would have the justification they needed to spread the big lie. So President Trump ultimately wanted the Department of Justice to say the election was, quote, corrupt, and, quote, leave the rest to me and the Republican congressmen. As you will hear today, the department's top leadership refused. Not surprisingly, President Trump didn't take no for an answer. He didn't accept it from Attorney General Barr, and he wouldn't accept it from Mr. Rosen either. So he looked for another attorney general, his third in 2 weeks. He needed to find someone who was willing to ignore the facts. That is not the norm. Let's look at what attorneys general, Democrats and Republicans alike, have said about upholding their oath to the Constitution.
Attorney General ultimately owes his loyalty to the integrity of the American people and to the fidelity to the Constitution and the legitimate laws of the country. That's what he's ultimately required to do.
I will be an independent attorney general. I will be the people's lawyer. If, however, there were an issue that I thought were that significant that would compromise my ability to serve as attorney general in the way that I have described, that as the people's lawyer, I would not hesitate to resign.
As you and I discussed, if the president proposed to undertake a course of conduct that was in violation of the Constitution, that would present me with a difficult but not a complex problem. I would have two choices. I could either try to talk him out of it or leave. Those are the choices.
The Attorney General's position as a cabinet member is perhaps unique from all of the cabinet members. Yes, a member of the president's cabinet, but the Attorney General has a unique responsibility to provide independent and objective advice to the president or any agency when it is sought, and sometimes perhaps even when it is not sought.
Everyone in that video, from Eric Holder to Jeff Sessions, spoke as one about the independence of the department. It's a point of pride at Justice to apply the law without the president's political self-interests tainting its actions or dictating how it uses its authorities. But President Trump did find one candidate at Justice who seemed willing to do anything to help him stay in power. Let's hear what President Trump's own lawyer, Eric Hirschman, had to say about Jeff Clark's plan to overturn the election. I'd like to advise viewers this video contains some strong language.
And when he finished discussing what he planned on doing, I said, good fucking, excuse me, sorry, a-hole. Congratulations, you just admitted your first step or act you take as attorney general would be committing a felony and violating Rule 6C. You're clearly the right candidate for this job.
So who's Jeff Clark? An environmental lawyer with no experience relevant to leading the entire Department of Justice. What was his only qualification? That he would do whatever the president wanted him to do, including overthrowing a free and a fair democratic election. President Trump's campaign to bend the Justice Department to his political will culminated in a showdown on January 3rd. Today, we will take you inside that early evening Oval Office meeting where top Justice Department officials met with the president. At stake, the leadership and integrity of the Department of Justice.
The meeting took about another 2.5 hours from the time I entered. It was entirely focused on whether there should be a DOJ leadership change. I was sitting directly in front of the president. Jeff Rosen was to my right, Jeff Clark was to my left. He looked at me and he underscored, well, the one thing we know is you're not going to do anything. You don't even agree that the concerns that are being presented are valid, and here's someone who has a different view. So, well, why shouldn't I do that? You know, that's how the discussion then proceeded.
Jeff Clark was proposing that Jeff Rosen be replaced by Jeff Clark, and I thought the proposal was asinine.
What were Clark's purported bases for why it was in the president's interest for him to step in? What would he do? How would things change, according to Mr. Clark in the meeting?
He repeatedly said to the president that if he was put in the seat, he would conduct real investigations that would, in his view, uncover widespread fraud. He would send out the letter that he had drafted, and that this was a last opportunity to sort of set things straight with this defective election, and that he could do it. And he had the intelligence and the will and the desire to pursue these matters in the way that the president thought most appropriate.
And he was making a pitch, and every time he'd get clobbered over the head, he would like call to order, you know, the president's your decision, you get the chance to make this decision, and you know, you've heard everybody and you can make your determination. And then we jump back in and, you know, really clobber him.
I made the point that Jeff Clark is not even competent to serve as the attorney general. He's never been a criminal attorney. He's never conducted a criminal investigation in his life. He's never been in front of a grand jury, much less a trial jury. And he kind of retorted by saying, well, I've done a lot of very complicated appeals and civil litigation, environmental litigation and things like that. And I said, that's right. You're an environmental lawyer. How about you go back to your office and we'll call you when there's an oil spill. And Pat Cipollone weighed in at one point, I remember saying, you know, that letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact. It's going to damage everyone who touches it. And we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. And so we went along those lines.
I thought Jeff's proposal, Clark's proposal, was nuts. I mean, this guy said at a certain point, you know, listen, the best I can tell is the only thing you know about environmental and elections challenges is they both start with E. And based on your answer tonight, I'm not even certain you know that.
The president said, suppose I do this. Suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What do you do?
Well, we know these men before us did the right thing. But think about what happens if these justice officials make a different decision. What happens if they bow to the pressure? What would that do to us as a democracy, as a nation? Imagine a future where the president could screen applicants to the Justice Department with one question. Are you loyal to me or to the Constitution? And it wouldn't take long to find people willing to pledge their loyalty to the man. We know many of President Trump's vocal supporters on January 6 also wanted the Justice Department to do whatever he asked, as long as it meant he could stay in power. They made sure Justice Department officials heard his message as they protested loudly in front of the department on their way to the Capitol on January 6th. I want to take a moment now to speak directly to my fellow Republicans. Imagine the country's top prosecutor with the power to open investigations, subpoena, charge crimes, and seek imprisonment. Imagine that official pursuing the agenda of the other party instead of that of the American people as a whole. And if you're a Democrat, imagine it the other way around. Today, President Trump's total disregard for the Constitution and his oath will be fully exposed. Now, let's get this hearing underway so we can do our part to protect the freedoms that we often take for granted, so that we can see how close we came to losing it all. I now yield back to the chairman.
We're joined today by three distinguished witnesses who each served in the Trump administration in the months preceding January 6th. Mr. Jeffrey Rosen served at the Department of Justice from May 2019 until January 2021. With President Trump's nomination and the confirmation of the United States Senate, he became the United States Deputy Attorney General. In December 2020, he took the mantle of Acting Attorney General. Mr. Richard Donahue has served in the Department of Justice for over 14 years. Mr. Donahue was a United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, then became Mr. Rosen's Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General, and finally, Acting Deputy Attorney General. Mr. Donahue also served more than 20 years in the United States military, including the 82nd Airborne and the Judge Advocates General Corps. We are also joined by Mr. Stephen Engel, the former Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. He was nominated by the former president and confirmed by the Senate during the Trump administration. He served from November 2017 to January 2021 and has now returned to private practice. I will now swear in our witnesses. The witnesses will please stand and raise their right hands. Do you swear under penalty of perjury that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you. You may be seated. Let the record reflect the witnesses all answered in the affirmative. I now recognize myself for questions. First of all, gentlemen, thank you for being here today. All of you served at former President Trump's pleasure at the Department of Justice in top leadership positions with tremendous responsibilities. Former Attorney General Bill Barr told the Select Committee that before he left the department in December 2020, he told President Trump on at least three occasions there was no evidence of widespread election fraud that would have changed the results of the presidential election, and refuted numerous specific claims of election fraud the president was making. Mr. Rosen, after Mr. Barr announced his resignation, did Donald Trump continue to demand that the Department of Justice investigate his claims of election fraud?
Yes. He asserted that he thought the Justice Department had not done enough.
Thank you. From the time you took over from Attorney General Barr until January 3rd, how often did President Trump contact you or the department to push allegations of election fraud?
So between December 23rd and January 3rd, the president either called me or met with me virtually every day, with one or two exceptions, like Christmas Day. And before that, because I had been announced that I would become the acting attorney general before the date I actually did, the president had asked that Rich Donahue and I go over and meet with him, I believe, on December 15th as well.
So after you had some of these meetings and conversations with the president, what things did the president raise with you?
So the common element of all of this was the president expressing his dissatisfaction that the Justice Department, in his view, had not done enough to investigate election fraud. But at different junctures, other topics came up at different intervals. So at one point, he had raised the question of having a special counsel for election fraud. At a number of points, he raised requests that I meet with his campaign counsel, Mr. Giuliani. At one point, he raised the whether the Justice Department would file a lawsuit in the Supreme Court. At a couple of junctures, there were questions about making public statements or about holding a press conference. One of the later junctures was this issue of sending a letter to state legislatures in Georgia or other states. And so there were different things raised at different parts of or different intervals, with the common theme being his dissatisfaction about what the Justice Department had done to investigate election fraud. I will say that the Justice Department declined all of those requests that I was just referencing, because We did not think that they were appropriate based on the facts and the law as we understood them.
Thank you. So, Mr. Donahue, on December 15th, the day after Attorney General Barr announced his resignation, the president summoned you and Mr. Rosen to the White House. At this meeting with the president, what did he want to discuss?
There were a number of topics of discussion that day, Mr. Chairman. Much of the conversation focused on a report that had been recently released relating to Antrim County in Michigan. I believe on December 13th, an organization called the Allied Security Group issued a report that alleged that the Dominion voting machines in that county had a 68% error rate. The report was widely covered in the media. We were aware of it. We obtained a copy of it on the 14th of December, the day prior. We circulated to the U.S. attorneys in Michigan for their awareness. And we had a number of discussions internally, but the conversation with the president on that day, the 15th, was largely focused on that. And he was essentially saying, have you seen this report? He was adamant that the report must be accurate, that it proved that the election was defective, that he, in fact, won the election, and the department should be using that report to tell the American people that the results were not trustworthy. And he went on to other theories as well, but the bulk of that conversation on December 15th focused on Antrim County, Michigan, and the ASOG report.
Thank you. Mr. Engel, we know that Attorney General Barr announced on December 1st, 2020, that the Department of Justice had found no evidence of widespread fraud that could have changed the outcome of the election. So from December 1st, 2020 until today, as you sit here, have you ever doubted that top line conclusion?
No, I've never had any reason to doubt Attorney General Barr's conclusion.
Thank you. Pursuant to Section 5C8 of House Resolution 503, the chair now recognizes the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Kingsinger, for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the weeks leading to January 6th, the Department of Justice was fielding almost daily requests from the president to investigate claims of election fraud. Each claim was refuted time and time again, an effort Attorney General Barr described as whack-a-mole. When each of the president's efforts failed, he resorted to installing a new attorney general to say the election was illegal and corrupt, simply so he could stay in power. President Trump started leaning on the Justice Department the first chance he got. On November 29th, his first television interview after the election.
Where is the DOJ and the FBI in all of this, Mr. President? You have laid out some serious charges here. Shouldn't this be something that the FBI is investigating? Are they?
Missing in action.
Is the DOJ investigating?
Missing in action. Can't tell you where they are.
Republican congressmen echoed the president just 2 days later. They wrote a letter to Attorney General Barr, laying into the Justice Department for a, quote, shocking lack of action in investigating the claims of election fraud. That same day, Attorney General Barr stated publicly that President Trump's claims had no merit. Ignoring the top law enforcement officer in the country, Republican congressmen amplified the stolen election message to the American public. Let's listen.
And so there's widespread evidence of fraud because people haven't done their jobs. Durham and Barr will deserve a big notation in history when it's written of the rise and fall of the United States if they don't clean up this mess, clean up the fraud. Do your jobs and save this little experiment in self-government.
Again, I join my colleagues in calling on Attorney General Barr to immediately let us know what he's doing.
We're already working on challenging the certified electors. And then what about the courts? How pathetic are the courts?
January 6th. I'm joining with the fighters in the Congress, and we are going to object to electors from states that didn't run clean elections. Democracy is left undefended if we accept the result of a stolen election without fighting with every bit of vigor we can muster.
The ultimate date of significance is January 6th. This is how the process works. The ultimate arbiter here, the ultimate check and balance, is the United States Congress. And when something is done in an unconstitutional fashion, which happened in several of these states, we have a duty to step forward and have this debate and have this vote on the 6th of January.
Today is the day American patriots start taking down names and kicking ass.
Mr. Donahue, on December 27th, you had a 90-minute conversation with the president where he raised false claim after false claim with you and Mr. Rosen. How did you respond to what you called a, quote, stream of allegations?
The December 27th conversation was, in my mind, an escalation of the earlier conversations. As the former acting AG indicated, there were a lot of communications that preceded that. As we got later in the month of December, the president's entreaties became more urgent. He became more adamant that we weren't doing our job. We need to step up and do our job. And he had this arsenal of allegations that he wanted to rely on. And so I felt in that conversation that it was incumbent on me to make it very clear to the president what our investigations had revealed, and that we had concluded, based on actual investigations, actual witness interviews, actual reviews of documents, that these allegations simply had no merit. And I wanted to try to cut through the noise, because it was clear to us that there were a lot of people whispering in his ear, feeding him these conspiracy theories and allegations, and I felt that being very blunt in that conversation might help make it clear to the president that these allegations were simply not true. And so as he went through them in what for me was a 90-minute conversation or so, and what for the former acting AG was a two-hour conversation, as the president went through them, I went piece by piece to say, no, that's false, that is not true, and to correct him really in a serial fashion as he moved from one theory to another.
Can you give me an example of one or two of those theories?
So one that was very clear at that point was the Antrim County, the ASOG report that I mentioned earlier. The Allied Security Operations Group released this report that's at 68% error rate. There was, in fact, in Antrim County, a hand recount. Had nothing to do with the department. The department did not request that. That was pursuant to litigation brought by other parties. But there was a hand recount. So they were able to compare the hand recount to what the machines had reported. And for the ballots that were actually counted by the machine, more than 15,000, there was one error, one ballot. And I did a quick calculation and came up with 0.0063% error rate, which is well within tolerance. And so I made it very clear to the president, because he was so fixated on the ASOG report in the December 15th conversation, that in fact, our investigation revealed that the error rate was 0.0063%. So that, Mr. President's example, what people are telling you, that is not true, and that you cannot and should not be relying on. So that was one very explicit one, and I think you see that reflected in my notes. We went through a series of others. The truck driver who claimed to have moved an entire tractor-trailer of ballots from New York to Pennsylvania, that was also incorrect. We did an investigation where the FBI interviewed witnesses at the front end and the back end of that trailer's transit from New York to Pennsylvania. We looked at loading manifests. We interviewed witnesses, including, of course, the driver, and we knew it wasn't true. Whether the driver believed or not was never clear to me, but it was just not true. So that was another one that I tried to educate the president on. There were a series of others, mostly in swing states. Of course, he wanted to talk a great deal about Georgia, the State Farm Arena video, which he believed, for various reasons, was, as he said it, fraud staring you right in the face.
Were any of the allegations he brought up found credible? Did you find any of them credible?
No.
So during this conversation, did you take handwritten notes directly quoting the president?
I did, and to make it clear, Attorney General Rosen called me on my government cell phone, said he'd been on the phone with the president for some time. The president had a lot of these allegations. I was better versed in what the department had done, just because I had closer contact with the investigations, and The AG asked me to get on the call. Of course, I agreed. And I began taking notes only because at the outset, the president made an allegation I had not heard. I had heard many of these things. I knew many of them were investigated. But when the president, at least when I came to the conversation, when he began speaking, he brought up an allegation I was completely unaware of. And of course, that concerned us. So I simply reached out and grabbed a notepad off my wife's nightstand and a pen, and I started jotting it down. That had to do with an allegation that more than 200,000 votes were certified in the state of Pennsylvania that were not actually cast. Sometimes the president would say it was 205, sometimes he would say it was 250, but I'd not heard this before, and I want to get the allegation down clearly so that we can look into it if appropriate, and that's why I started taking those notes, and then as the conversation continued, I just continued to take the notes.
Let's take a look at the notes, if we could right now. As we can see on the screen, you actually quote President Trump asking, where's DOJ, just like we heard him say in his first television interview. How did you respond to that?
So both the acting AG and I tried to explain to the president on this occasion and on several other occasions that the Justice Department has a very important, very specific, but very limited role in these elections. States run their elections. We are not quality control for the states. We are obviously interested in and have a mission that relates to criminal conduct in relation to federal elections. We also have related civil rights responsibilities, so we do have an important role. But the bottom line was, if a state ran their election in such a way that it was defective, that is to the state or Congress to correct. It is not for the Justice Department to step in. And I certainly understood the president as a layman not understanding why the Justice Department didn't have at least a civil role to step in and bring suit on behalf of the American people. We tried to explain that to him. The American people do not constitute the client for the United States Justice Department. The one and only client of the United States Justice Department is the United States government. And the United States government does not have standing, as we were repeatedly told by our internal teams, OLC led by Steve Engel, as well as the Office of the Solicitor General, researched it and gave us thorough, clear opinions that we simply did not have standing. And we tried to explain that to the president on numerous occasions.
Let's take a look at another one of your notes. You also noted that Mr. Rosen said to Mr. Trump, quote, DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. How did the president respond to that, sir?
He responded very quickly and said, essentially, that's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
So let's now put up the notes where you quote the president. As you're speaking to that, he said, the president said, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. So, Mr. Donahue, that's a direct quote from President Trump, correct?
That's an exact quote from the president, yes.
The next note shows that even that the president kept pressing, even though he had been told that there was no evidence of fraud, did the president keep saying that the department was, quote, obligated to tell people that this was an illegal, corrupt election?
That's also an exact quote from the president, yes.
Let me just be clear. Did the department find any evidence to conclude that there was anything illegal or corrupt about the 2020 election?
There were isolated instances of fraud. None of them came close to calling into question the outcome of the election in any individual state.
And how would you describe the president's demeanor during that call?
He was more agitated than he was on December 15th. The president throughout all of these meetings and telephone conversations was adamant that he had won and that we were not doing our job. But it did escalate over time until ultimately the meeting on January 3rd, which was sort of the most extreme of the meetings and conversations.
So I want to make sure we don't gloss this over. Just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to us. The president wanted the top Justice Department officials to declare that the election was corrupt, even though, as he knew, there was absolutely no evidence to support that statement. The president didn't care about actually investigating the facts. He just wanted the Department of Justice to put its stamp of approval on the lies. Who was going to help him? Well, Jeff Clark. Mr. Rosen, on Christmas Eve, your first official day as the acting attorney general, President Trump called you. What did he want to talk about?
The same things he was talking about publicly. He wanted to talk about that he thought the election had been stolen or was corrupt, and that there was widespread fraud. And I had told him that our reviews had not shown that to be the case. So we had an extended discussion, probably 15, maybe 20 minutes, something like that, with him. Urging that the Department of Justice should be doing more with regard to election fraud.
Did he mention Jeff Clark's name?
Yes. It was just in passing. He made what I regarded as a peculiar reference. I don't remember the exact quote, but it was something about, did I know Jeff Clark, or did I know who he was, or something like that. And I told him I did, and then the conversation just moved on. But when I hung up, I was quizzical as to how does the president even know Mr. Clark? I was not aware that they had ever met or that the president had been involved with any of the issues in the civil division.
It was a bit of a surprise when he brought his name up.
Yes.
So Mr. Clark was the acting head of the civil division and head of Environmental and Natural Resources Division at the Department of Justice. Do either of those divisions have any role whatsoever in investigating election fraud, sir?
No. And to my awareness, Jeff Clark had no prior involvement of any kind with regard to the work that the department was doing that Attorney General Barr has talked about to this committee.
So let's take a minute and explain why the president mentioned Jeff Clark's name to Mr. Rosen here on Christmas Eve. On December 21st, some Republican members of Congress met with President Trump in the White House to talk about overturning the 2020 election. Let's hear Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene talk about how this meeting got set up.
I was the only new member at the meeting. I called President Trump on Saturday and said, we've got to have a meeting. There's many of us that feel like this election has been stolen.
So on the screen, you'll see that President Trump's Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, tweeted about that meeting right after it happened. He said, quote, several members of Congress just finished a meeting in the Oval Office with President Donald Trump, preparing to fight back against mounting evidence of voter fraud. Stay tuned. On the same day he met with these Republican members of Congress, President Trump called into a conservative political convention, and he used the opportunity to pressure the Department of Justice to investigate his bogus claims.
The problem is we need a party that's going to fight, and we have some great congressmen and women that are doing it, and we have others, some great fighters, but we won this in a landslide. They know it, and we need backing from, like, the Justice Department, and other people have to finally step up.
The Select Committee obtained records from the National Archives that show that Scott Perry was one of the congressmen who joined that meeting. We learned from White House records that you'll now see on the screen that the very next day, Representative Perry returned to the White House. This time, he brought a Justice Department official named Jeffrey Clark. Representative Perry provided the following statement to his local TV affiliate. He said, quote, throughout the past 4 years, I've worked with Assistant Attorney General Clark on various legislative matters. When President Trump asked if I would make an introduction, I obliged. But why Jeff Clark? Let's hear Mr. Giuliani explain the kind of person that he and the president wanted at the top of justice.
I don't remember ever recommending to anybody that Mr. Clark, meaning Jeffrey Clark at DOJ, be given election-related responsibilities.
You mean beyond the president?
Correct.
Well, beyond the president, I do recall saying to people that somebody should be put in charge of the Justice Department who isn't frightened of what's going to be done to their reputation. Because Justice Department was filled with people like that.
Should put somebody that's not frightened of what's going to be done to their reputation. Mr. Donahue, when you told the president that you wouldn't pursue baseless claims of fraud, was it because you were worried about your reputation?
No, not at all.
Mr. Clark's name was also mentioned in the White House in late December and early January as described by a top aide to Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson.
Was it your understanding that Representative Perry was pushing for a specific person to take over the department?
He wanted Mr. Jeff Clark to take over the Department of Justice.
Mr. Rosen, after your call with President Trump on December 24th, you spoke with Mr. Clark on December 26th about his contact with the president. Can you tell us about that conversation?
Yes. Because I had been quizzical about why his name had come up, I called him and I tried to explore if he would share if there was something I ought to know. And after some back and forth, he acknowledged that shortly before Christmas, he had gone to a meeting in the Oval Office with the president. That, of course, surprised me. And I asked him, how did that happen? And he was defensive. He said it had been unplanned, that he had been talking to someone he referred to as General Perry, but I believe as Congressman Perry, and that unbeknownst to him, he was asked to go to a meeting and he didn't know it, but it turned out it was at the Oval. He found himself at the Oval Office. And he was apologetic for that. And I said, well, you didn't tell me about it. It wasn't authorized. And you didn't even tell me after the fact. You know, this is not appropriate. But he was contrite and said it had been inadvertent and it would not happen again. And that if anyone asked him to go to such a meeting, he would notify Rich Donahue and me.
Is there a policy that governs who can have contact directly with the White House?
Yes. So across many administrations for a long period of time, there's a policy that, particularly with regard to criminal investigations, restricts at both the White House end and the Justice Department end those more sensitive issues to the highest ranks. So for criminal matters, the policy for a long time has been that only the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General from the DOJ side can have conversations about criminal matters with the White House, or the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General can authorize someone for a specific item with their permission, but the idea is to make sure that the top rung of the Justice Department knows about it and is in the thing to control it and make sure only appropriate things are done.
Mr. Ringo, from your perspective, why is it important to have a policy like Mr. Rosen just discussed?
Well, it's critical that the Department of Justice conducts its criminal investigations free from either the reality or any appearance of political interference. And so people can get in trouble if people at the White House are speaking with people at the department. And that's why the purpose of these policies is to keep these communications as infrequent and at the highest levels as possible, just to make sure that people who are less careful about it, who don't really understand these implications, such as Mr. Clark, don't run afoul of those contact policies.
Thank you. So the Select Committee conducted an informal interview with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Pat Philbin, about their contact with Mr. Clark, though neither has yet agreed to sit for transcribed and videotaped interviews. But Pat Cipollone told the Select Committee that he intervened when he heard Mr. Clark was meeting with the president about legal matters without his knowledge, which was strictly against White House policy. Mr. Cipollone and Mr. Philbin, like Mr. Rosen, told Mr. Clark to stand down, and he didn't. On the same day, Acting Attorney General Rosen told Mr. Clark to stop talking to the White House. Representative Perry was urging Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to elevate Clark within the Department of Justice. You can now see on the screen behind me a series of texts between Representative Perry and Mr. Meadows. They show that Representative Perry requested that Mr. Clark be elevated within the department. Representative Perry tells Mr. Meadows on December 26th that, quote, Mark, just checking in as time continues to count down. 11 days to January 6th and 25 days to inauguration, we've got to get going. Representative Perry followed up and says, quote, Mark, you should call Jeff. I just got off the phone with him, and he explained to me why the principal deputy won't work, especially with the FBI. They will view it as not having the authority to enforce what needs to be done. Mr. Meadows responds with, I got it. I think I understand. Let me work on the deputy position. Representative Perry then texts, Roger, just sent you something on Signal. Just sent you an updated file. Did you call Jeff Clark? Mr. Donahue, Representative Perry called you the next day on December 27th. Who told him to call you?
My understanding is the president did at the outset of the call. Congressman Perry told me that he was calling at the behest of the president.
What did he want to talk about?
He wanted to talk about Pennsylvania in particular. He gave me some background about, you know, why he in particular doesn't trust the FBI and why the American people don't necessarily trust the FBI. And then he went into some allegations specific to Pennsylvania, which included, amongst others, this allegation that the Secretary of State had certified more votes than were actually cast.
Did you direct the local U.S. Attorney's Office to investigate that claim?
So Mr. Perry said that he had a great deal of information, that investigations had been done, that there was some sort of forensic-type report that would be helpful to me. And I didn't know Congressman Perry. I'd never heard of him before this conversation. But I said, sir, if you've got something that you think is relevant to what the Justice Department's mission is, you should feel free to send it to me. And he did. And I was en route from New York to Washington. I got it. I looked at it on my iPhone. Obviously, I couldn't read the whole thing in transit like that. But I looked at it to get a feel for what it was. And then I forwarded it to the United States Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania.
Did they get back to you? What did they conclude?
Scott Brady looked at it. He was the Western District of Pennsylvania U.S. attorney. Took him a couple days, but he got back in relatively short order with a pretty clear explanation for why there was no foundation for concern. The Secretary of State had not certified more votes than were actually cast. The difference between the 5.25 that was actually certified by the Secretary of State and the 5 million that was on a public-facing website was that the information on the website was incomplete because four counties had not uploaded their data.
So no credibility to that.
There was zero to that, right.
During that call, did Scott Perry mention Mr. Clark, and what did he say about him, if so?
He did. He mentioned Mr. Clark. He said something to the effect of, I think Jeff Clark is great, and I think he's the kind of guy who could get in there and do something about this stuff. And this was coming on the heels of the president having mentioned Mr. Clark in the afternoon call earlier that day.
I'd like to yield to the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Vice Chair Cheney.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kinzinger. I thank the gentleman for yielding. As we discussed earlier, at the center of Mr. Clark's plan to undo President Trump's election loss was a letter. Mr. Donahue, on December 28th, Mr. Clark emailed you and Mr. Rosen a draft letter that he wanted you to sign and send to Georgia state officials. You testified that this could have, quote, grave constitutional consequences. Mr. Donahue, can you tell us what you meant by that?
Well, I had to read both the email and the attached letter twice to make sure I really understood what he was proposing, because it was so extreme to me. I had a hard time getting my head around it initially. But I read it, and I did understand it for what he intended. And I had to sit down and sort of compose what I thought was an appropriate response. I actually initially went next door to the acting AG's office, but he was not there. We were both on that email. I knew we would both have probably a very similar reaction to it. He was not in his office, so I returned to my office, and I sat down to draft a response because I thought it was very important to give a prompt response rejecting this out of hand. There were, in my response, I explained a number of reasons this is not the department's role to suggest or dictate to state legislatures how they should select their electors. But more importantly, this was not based on fact. This was actually contrary to the facts as developed by department investigations over the last several weeks and months. So I responded to that, and for the department to insert itself into the political process this way, I think would have had grave consequences for the country. It may very well have spiraled us into a constitutional crisis, and I wanted to make sure that he understood the gravity of the situation because he didn't seem to really appreciate it.
And what was Mr. Clark's reaction when you sent this email to him?
He didn't respond directly to the email, but we met shortly after that. After I sent the email, the acting AG returned. I went to his office. He had just read it. He had a very similar reaction to me. He was exasperated, and he told me that he had told one of his administrative assistants to get Jeff Clark up here. We want to talk to him face-to-face about this. And so the three of us then had a meeting, probably around 1800 that night, in the Deputy Attorney General's conference room.
And one of the things that you said to Mr. Clark is, quote, what you are doing is nothing less than the United States Justice Department meddling in the outcome of a presidential election. And I assume you conveyed that to him as well in your meeting that evening?
Yes, in those very words. It was a very contentious meeting, but yes, that was said amongst other things.
And despite this contentious meeting and your strong reaction to the letter, did Mr. Clark continue to push his concept in the coming days?
He did, yes. We had subsequent meetings and conversations. The acting AG probably had more contact with him than I did. But between the 28th and the 2nd, when we had another in-person meeting, he clearly continued to move down this path. He began calling witnesses and apparently conducting investigations of his own. He got a briefing from DNI about purported foreign intelligence interference. And we thought perhaps once it was explained to him that there was no basis for that part of his concern, that he would retreat. But instead, he doubled down and said, well, okay, so there's no foreign interference. I still think there are enough allegations out there that we should go ahead and send this letter, which shocked me even more than the initial one, because you would think after a couple days of looking at this, he, like we, would have come to the same conclusion that it was completely unfounded.
And when you learned that he had been calling witnesses and conducting investigations on his own, did you confront him?
Yes.
And what was his reaction?
He got very defensive. You know, as I said, there were a series of conversations through that week. I certainly remember very specifically the conversation in the meeting on January 2nd. That got even more confrontational. But he was defensive and, you know, similar to his earlier reaction when I said this is nothing less than Justice Department meddling in an election, his reaction was, I think a lot of people have meddled in this election. And so he kind of clung to that and then spewed out some of these theories, some of which we'd heard from the president, but others which were floating around the internet and media, and just kept insisting that the department needed to act and needed to send those letters.
The committee has also learned that Mr. Clark was working with another attorney at the department named Ken Klukowski, who drafted this letter to Georgia with Mr. Clark. Mr. Klukowski had arrived at the department on December 15th with just 36 days left until the inauguration. He was specifically assigned to work under Jeff Clark. And Mr. Klukowski also worked with John Eastman, who we showed you at our hearing last week was one of the primary architects of President Trump's scheme to overturn the election. The Georgia letter that we've been discussing specifically talks about some of Dr. Eastman's theories, including, quote, the purpose of the special session the department recommends would be for the General Assembly to determine whether the election failed to make a proper and valid choice between the candidates, such that the General Assembly could take whatever action is necessary to ensure that one of the slates of electors cast on December 14th will be accepted by Congress on January 6th. Committees also learned that the relationship between Dr. Eastman and Mr. Klukowski persisted after Mr. Klukowski joined the Justice Department. Let's take a look at an email recommending that Mr. Klukowski and Dr. Eastman brief Vice President Pence and his staff. Other recipients of this email included the Chief of Staff to Congressman Louie Gohmert. And the email says, as stated last week, I believe the Vice President and his staff would benefit greatly from a briefing by John and Ken. As I also mentioned, we want to make sure we don't overexpose Ken, given his new position. This email suggests that Mr. Klukowski was simultaneously working with Jeffrey Clark to draft the proposed letter to Georgia officials to overturn their certified election, and working with Dr. Eastman to help pressure the vice president to overturn the election. I want to thank all of our witnesses for being here today and for answering our questions about this letter and other issues. We asked Mr. Clark some of the same questions that we've asked you, and here's how he answered.
Did you discuss this draft letter to Georgia officials with the President of the United States?
Fifth, and executive privilege, again, just restated for the abundance of caution.
Okay, if you look again at the draft letter, in the first paragraph, second sentence says, the department will update you as we are able on investigatory progress, but at this time we have identified significant concerns that may have impacted the outcome of the election in multiple states, including the state of Georgia. Isn't that, in fact, contrary to what Attorney General Barr had said on December 1st, 2020?
Fifth.
Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Mr. Chairman, I reserve.
Pursuant to the order of the committee of today, the chair declares the committee in recess for a period of approximately 10 minutes.